This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to Wealthion. I'm your host, Andrew Brill. It's been a big week for the economy with the Fed deciding on whether or not interest rates should come down. But is the economy humming along and it doesn't really matter just yet? We'll discuss that more coming up next. Our mission here at Wealthion is to help all of us keep and grow our money, but Wealthion's not just a channel. It's a conversation with our community, so please keep the feedback coming. If there's something you'd like to talk about or someone you'd like to hear from, let us know. And if you could like and subscribe to the channel, we'd really appreciate it. Now let's dive into discussion. I'd like to welcome in Dryden Pence, the Chief Investment Officer at Pence Wealth Management. Mr. Pence is a former military intelligence officer specializing in psychological warfare. He's received the Bronze Star Army Commendation Medal with V for Valor in Combat, the Meritorious Service Medal, and the Legion of Merit from the U.S. Army, one of the highest honors after all that. Mr. Pence is trained as an economist and can be seen on CNBC and Bloomberg. Dryden, welcome to Wealthion. And before we get started, on behalf of all of us here in the Wealthion family, I'd like to thank you for your service.
Well, thank you very much. And to everybody on Wealthion, if no one's ever told you this, thank you for paying your taxes. It's important. And the reason why I say that is my daughter has a dad because some taxpayer bought me an armor-plated Humvee and a flak jacket, and I needed it one day. And so I'm alive, and there's thousands and thousands of soldiers out there that are alive because you as an American taxpayer bought them body armor that keeps them safe. So thank you very much. If no one's ever said that to you, it may make that check a little easier to write. But thank you very much.
Well, we appreciate you, and obviously you guys and all the servicemen appreciate everyone paying their taxes, because that's it goes a long way for keeping our soldiers safe. So I just want to ask you, psychological warfare sounds like you're dealing with the stock market and the economy.
Very much so. I mean, part of it comes down to the question of what makes large groups of people do certain things. And when you take a look at the stock market, when you take a look at the economy, really it's just a mathematical calculation of human behavior. And every dollar's a vote. Right. Yeah. Everyone decides to do one thing more than something else. Right. I want to spend $1 here versus $1 there. Invest $1 here versus $1 there. So every dollar is a vote. And it all really comes down to human behavior and trying to decide what's going to make a lot of people do one particular thing and trying to get in front of that. I mean, we talk about it like human behavior drives consumption. And that's the big thing. Human behavior drives consumption. Nobody makes a penny until someone decides to buy. And so if you can begin to think about getting in front of human beings' decision-making cycles, you can be a little bit predictive about what someone's going to buy and who they're going to buy it from. And those are the companies we try to focus on.
So it's a little bit of that opportunity cost of what they're spending money on. It's like, oh, I'm going to spend it here and find a little bit of happiness and not spend it there. But let's talk about the economy a little bit. You know, the indicators, consumer prices are up. Consumer confidence, according to the newest Michigan study, is slightly down, but jobs are good. There's so many different ups and downs with the economics of it all. You wonder, you know, the economy seems to be doing okay, but there's a lot of gloom and doom around the economy. But when we had a discussion, you're like, no, this economy, you know, don't look at it as gloom and doom. We're really doing okay.
Well, I think that's the case. I mean, the important thing for people to realize, and this is what people have forgotten, We've got more people working today, making more money than at any other time in our nation's history. If you go back and look at just the pre-pandemic, you know, we were at the peak right before the pandemic. Everybody can remember that. That was all good. We've added 5.3 million more people to the job roles, all making money since then. So we've got 5.3 million more people working now than we had at the height pre-pandemic. When you think about that, that's like adding the entire labor force of Georgia, right, all at once, dropping them in Ohio. And it's even picked up in the last year. In the last year, we added 2.7 million people. That's like taking the entire labor force of South Carolina and dropping it in Ohio or Illinois or somewhere. And so when you have more people working, making more money than before, the American consumer spends. I mean, that's what we do. It's our national pastime. That's why they call it retail therapy. And so when you have that much money, we've added in just the last 3 years, what's the equivalent of the entire GDP of Italy? Italy's the eighth largest economy in the world. So in the U.S., we've grown Italy in the last 3 or 4 years. That's huge. And all of that money has a multiplier effect. It's working its way through the economy. So people are trying to say gloom and doom and things like that. You know, and people take a look at the unemployment rate too. I mean, you know, when you think about it, we've had, you know, 25 quarters of unemployment below 4%. The last time that happened was 1969. So we're in this long stretch of really good data, of really good facts. Nobody wants to feel that way because I mean, bad news sells, or everybody tries to play gloom and doom or whatever it is. But when you look at the underlying math and the underlying data and recognize that more people are working than ever before, labor productivity is at an all-time high, incomes are just about an all-time high, all of these things are moving in the right direction. It's very hard to say we're going to have this gloom and doom recessions everybody's talking about. We've got 1.4 jobs for every person looking. I mean, it's you know, I think that it's definitely a glass half full, and we're going to see that work its way through the economy and through the markets and through, you know, everything we have going forward. So we're pretty positive. It's going to, you know, it's like this. You drive a car at 90 miles an hour. I know no one wants to admit that, but you drive a car at 90 miles an hour for a long period of time, and then you slow down to 50. You feel like you're standing still, but you're actually moving 10 times faster than you can possibly walk. And so during 2024, we see this there's going to be this slowing, and people are going to like, oh my gosh, it's awful. It's not. It's just moving from a torrid pace to a normal pace, and one that's more sustainable. So we're kind of constructive on the economy going forward.
So I want to ask you a question. We went through a period during the pandemic where there was a lot of money pumped into individuals, and everybody was scared. They weren't working. Things were shut down. People kind of saved that money. And as the country opened back up again, people started spending. So prices went up a little bit, and, you know, the money was flowing and everything was great. Are we getting to a point now with the increased income of people and the fact that there are jobs? Are we getting to a point where people are saying, okay, you know what? I spent my pandemic money. I used a little bit of my savings. Maybe I'll try and replenish that, so I'm not going to spend as much. It's not a matter of people don't have the money to spend, but they're trying to rebuild their coffers, if you will, because they weren't able to spend for a year and a half during the pandemic.
Well, I think you're touching on something that's very important here. It's kind of like I said, this is kind of a slowdown. People still have money. They're making money. They're finding this equilibrium back to this balance of how much cash do I have in reserves? How much do I have in the bank? How do I feel comfortable with the investment? So some of the spending is slowing down. But what's interesting is also the spending that people are doing is changing a little bit, right? I think people are spending more money on experiences. People are spending more money on, you know, sometimes luxury goods are things that are people looking at. Discretionary spending still seems to be reasonably robust. And you do see, and it's also a generational factor here, that you see people spending more on experiences necessarily than things. And I think that that is part of just the nature of human behavior changing a little bit in the post-pandemic world. Kind of do it now because you don't know when things are going to get shut down again. But I think that that's one of the factors that we see going forward. And that does affect investment themes as well. But the point I guess I'm trying to make is what you've described perfectly there is that thing that I was talking about, this movement from 90 to 50. It's not we're going into recession at all. It's we're moving back to some sort of normalization of American spending patterns, which are certainly quite robust.
So the Fed meets this week. Obviously, things are still looking pretty good. We don't expect a cut probably until maybe June or even July. But prices are still up. And we've passed, I'm assuming we've passed that post-pandemic or that pandemic, levels of where we couldn't get goods. We couldn't, there was a lack of things being produced. But we've kind of gotten past that. But prices aren't coming down the way we'd like as well.
Well, the easy work is done on inflation. The easy work is done on inflation. So much of the inflation was originally in energy prices, and we're seeing a little pushback on those. The spike we had that kind of panicked everybody, we spiked up to about 9.1. We're now moving down to a level that's more acceptable. You've got core PCE at around 2.4. You've got CPI at 3.1. And everybody's going to say, where are we? We're trying to get down to this 2 number. It's easy to go from 9 to 3. It's really hard to go from 3 to 2. And so it's going to take a while to get there. The Fed's not even expecting us to get to this magic 2 number, which is actually kind of one they just picked, until sometime in 2025. So I think that we really have to recognize the easy work's done, but also you have to have some perspective. If you go back to 1971, we've lived over half our lives with inflation rates over 3%, and we've lived over half our lives with a federal fund rate over 4%. So this idea that we have to get back to 2 to have a robust economy, that we have to get back to 2 to have everything work, is really a misnomer. So when you think about this long period of time, from 1971 forward, over half our lives inflation greater than 3, over half our lives Fed funds over 4. During that same period of time, you had an economy that grew GDP probably around 6. You had a stock market that compounded at about 7.5 on the S&P 500. So even in this environment that's unusual for us today, it's actually not unusual for over our long history. It's unusual for us today because we were used to a 10-year period of time where we had almost zero interest rates. We had almost zero inflation rates. But I think that the thing people forget is the way we got to that was we had a housing crisis and a banking crisis, and we had a lot of things go bad in 2008 and 2009. I don't think anybody wants to go back to that. If that's the price you have to pay for a 0% interest rate and a 2% inflation, I don't think anybody wants to go there. So I think that we just have to recognize this last adjustment period is going to be elongated, but it's not going to be one that's particularly destructive. Prices are going to be a little higher, inflation's going to be a little higher, but wages and incomes are higher. Real wage growth is there. So I think that it's just a matter of recognizing that the last 1% is the hardest, and it's going to take us a little while to get there. But we don't see anything bad coming out of this.
I mean, you've talked about not a soft landing, but no landing. And then there's you talk about housing, the Gen Zers who say, I'll never be able to afford a house. But, when you look at it, an interest rate at 7 isn't so bad. It's just the psychological, as you would know, the psychological thing. Oh, my 7% when, it was just 2.5%, 3% just, a year and a half ago. But now I'm going to pay 7%. Look, my first mortgage was almost 8%. So I get it. But there's we have to kind of retrain these younger people that, look, a 7% interest rate isn't the end of the world.
I've kind of said this a couple of times, Joe. You and I can remember getting a 6 or 7% interest rate and going, score, that's wonderful. Yeah, and a lot of your viewers probably can think of the same thing. You tell a millennial they're going to pay 7 or 8%, their heads will explode. But the point of the matter is we're just moving back to a more, I guess you'd call it, you had the old normal, you had the new normal, now we're getting back to what I'd call the real normal. And I think in this situation where it's basically a psychological adjustment period. And then, we look at this issue too, when you talk about home builders and you talk about housing, there is a housing shortage, and it's difficult. And part of it is you don't have people downsizing, because let's say if someone's got a 30-year mortgage, and this is the thing that you have to look at, someone who has a 30-year mortgage that they got a couple of years ago at 3%, they're not affected by these higher mortgage rates. They're just kind of like very happy paying their mortgage, and they're not in a hurry to sell their current house and move to another house with that mortgage not being portable. So that they're going like, I'm just going to stay where I am. Right. So you don't have as much sales in existing family homes because no one wants to, refi at a much higher rate. So I think that you're beginning to see some of these distortions. They're going to have to work themselves out through the economy. But again, that's kind of why we think the home building sector is going to, you're just going to have a lot more new homes because no one's going to sell the old ones because they don't want to get a new mortgage.
I know I'm not looking to sell mine or hop into a higher mortgage for sure, but there's the thinking that, prices are up, earnings are up. There's a lot of companies doing very, very well. There's the Magnificent Seven that have done very, very well. And now it looks like the bottom half of the S&P is going to start doing well also, because the economy is doing so well.
Well, I think that this is an important thing for people to recognize. If you look at markets, particularly when you look at 2023 and you look at the, so far parts of 2024, much of it was driven by the Magnificent Seven. You had these tech companies that were in this position and they were really driving, massive earnings expansion, and they've driven the market forward. Now what we see is this matures a little bit. We see that the broadening out of earnings growth, the broadening out of performance, is going to really lift the rest of the market. So we see a lot of opportunity in what we call the 493. And part of this goes back to the psychology around things. If you were a corporate CFO in 2022 or 2023, when interest rates are moving dramatically, you had no idea what your cost of capital was going to be. It's kind of like if you had a variable rate mortgage, right, and you didn't know how high interest rates were going to go, were you going to go out and buy a new car? Probably not, right, because you had no idea what your budget was going to be like. So we went through this period of time where corporate CFOs had no idea their cost of capital. They had really no idea of how to predict their margins. So everyone got more conservative. All of the estimates and predictions and plans around corporate earnings began to be pulled down. I mean, people are humans, right? And so they didn't want to go out on a limb. Well, what happened is that turned into an environment where across all the S&P 500, you see this much higher than normal beat ratio. Right. So you go through quarter after quarter after quarter, where instead of having, 50 or 60% of the company's beat earnings expectations, you're looking at 75 to 80 to 85% of the companies. And so now, as things are getting back to normal, corporate CFOs can predict their cost of capital. They know what their highest interest rate is. They can be very efficient. They can maintain and increase their margins, right? Because the next moves in interest rates are going to go down. So now you see this kind of robust push to earnings across the rest of the S&P 500. And we think that that bodes well for the market. If you kind of take a look at, the Magnificent Seven has elevated the PE ratios of the S&P 500 a little bit, but if you take a look at the rest of them, they're still at like 20, not at 23. So there's some margin expansion, there's PE expansion, and there's greater profitability. So we think that 2024 is going to be a record year for margins record year for earnings in the stock market, and that's going to help propel a robust market. We're pretty favorable going forward. I mean, if you look historically, when you get, say, you're in year two after a bad year, right? So you have a really bad year, down more than 10%, like 2022, and the next year you're up more than 10%. That third year, you're typically always up, more than around 10%. Election years, you're typically up 10 to 13%. So we think all of the normal historical factors plus the fundamental factors are looking for a market that's going to probably be in that 9 to 11, 9 to 12 overall. We may be a little ahead of ourselves now. We'll have a little volatility on the way as we get there. But you have that kind of volatility. This is the thing. Everybody gets worried when you have this moment of oh my gosh, the market's going to correct 10%. It does that pretty frequently. And I think people just have to recognize that that's part of the ebb and flow of emotions around markets, and learn to take advantage of volatility and not be its victim.
How do you coach someone through that? You know, it's like, oh my God, everybody says just buy and hold. The market just continues to go up, and don't worry so much about it. Don't look at it every day. But how do you coach someone through that who's going to call you and say, Dryden, I'm freaking out here. The market's on a downside. This is my retirement. What am I doing? Or this is my kid's college fund. What am I doing? How do you coach people through that?
I think you have to kind of separate the fundamentals from the emotion, and you have to ask the question, okay, there's this, something's happened and people are panicking. There's maybe a geopolitical event or whatever it is, right? And you have to go, is this really going to change human behavior at the consumer level? Are people going to stop, people may slow down on e-commerce, right? But they're not going to stop shopping. Right. People may slow down on certain things, but you're still going to go buy. I say invest in the no matter what. People are going to buy toilet paper no matter what. You're going to have a certain amount of gasoline no matter what. And we always look at how people do things. Right. So we really love e-commerce, because if people are going to continue to shop, then they're going to continue to use the most efficient means of shopping, which is online. And you see that level continue to grow over time. So we always kind of say, what people do doesn't change that much. How people do it changes. And we try to always get in front of a how and take advantage of that. That's kind of a big thing to look at.
So I want to get back to pricing and maybe interest rates coming down later this year. Maybe there'll be two cuts instead of three, so that when interest rates come down, companies are able to borrow money at a lower rate. They can lower their prices. Is this what we can foresee in the future? Because right now prices seem to be high, and especially food prices and things like that people are hurting a little bit. There's the people that are working hard, but their dollar doesn't seem to be stretching as far.
I think there's two or three sides to this. One is, during the peak inflation period of time, right? Everybody raised their prices, even if they didn't need to. You could finally get away with pushing through a price increase. You could blame it on inflation. And so, as we all know, prices go up faster than they come down quite frequently, right? And so companies are going to be able to, when we think about it from a company corporate profit standpoint, companies are going to, because they've been able to raise prices and have raised prices, they'll be slower lowering them, and that's going to increase margins, right? That's going to increase margins as they do it. And so I think that's going to bode well for the companies. As for the consumer, you are beginning to see, Walmart has talked about, which is the largest grocer in the nation, and they've talked about beginning to lower prices, beginning to move down that a little bit, and that's helpful. They're going to have competitive reasons to do so. So I think you're going to begin to see some of this come down, but it's going to be slow. That's why you take a look at the inflation numbers. I said this last 1% is going to be hard, because you look at core services, or you look at some of the more volatile. Volatile food, food and energy are a little more volatile, but you take a look at core services. That's the sticky part of inflation. That's slow to come down. And so I think the consumer may see some tightening, but we don't see it. We see it more as a reallocation of what they may be spending money on, not a complete slowdown in what they're spending money on. And so, again, this is part of this adjustment from 90 to 50, the speed limit that we're talking about.
Do you see those luxury items coming down as well? Because eventually people are going to stop spending as much. They won't stop spending on the luxury goods, going out to eat or vacations, stuff like that. But do you see those prices coming down as well?
Not as much. I think the thing that I'm going to look at is margins. I mean, our job is to find protect people's wealth and to grow it, right? So I'm going to focus a lot on corporate margins. I'm going to say, who's making money? We try to find companies that are making money and who's going to make the most money out of whatever behavior there is. So when you look at, we kind of call it what we call choke point investing. Where you look at there's a supply chain between the satisfaction of human demand, right? You get from where you are to where you want to be. And a choke point is a military term, but it talks about it's a place where somebody controls a piece of the supply chain. And think of it as a bridge across a river, right? If you control the bridge, you control the satisfaction people trying to get across. Well, you can charge them a toll. You can charge them a higher price, right? And when you look at that, we look for the companies that occupy a choke point, that have a little bit of a monopoly, that have pricing power, either because their good is scarce, in other words, they're the only person that makes it, or maybe one or two people that make it, or that there is a abnormal demand for that good because it is a brand. It's something that somebody wants that is willing to pay more because of what it looks like or what it might be than what it may factually, you know, the sum of its parts, right? So I think that when we look at luxury goods, they occupy a choke point in human psyche. You want this thing and you're willing to pay more for it because it's not just a purse. It's a particular purse. It's an LVMH purse. It's something that in and of itself makes you happier because you own it. And so when we look at luxury goods, we find that their profit margins are going to be able to be more sustainable in any type of environment. And the demand tends to be more sustainable in almost any type of environment because the people that have the money to buy those things tend to be less inflation sensitive and less market sensitive. And you also got to remember that, you know, people have made a lot of money in the stock market over the last couple of years, right? So incomes are made up not just of wages that you earn, but of portfolio earnings. And this is spread out across a much wider segment of the American consumer. So I think we're a little bit more resistant to, you know, some of the normal cycles because everybody's kind of got this additional cushion to satisfaction of their demand. So we look for the choke point companies that people are going to buy from no matter what.
One of those that seems to be an abnormal cycle is this whole AI thing. And now NVIDIA this week is having their conference. And I'm sure there's going to be a little news tidbits out of there that are going to make stocks go crazy. The AI stocks, the Magnificent Seven, there room to grow there?
I think, you know, data is the new gold. I mean, I think that's when you think about our ability to understand what the consumer's doing, what companies are doing, how we can be more efficient, how AI can help really any company. If you take artificial intelligence and combine it with a human, you increase labor productivity. Increasing labor productivity is the solution for inflation. We get better outcomes from every dollar of input. And so when you think about that, the demand for what these companies do, I mean, data is, we're producing like five times more data every day than we did in 1999. It's just tremendous, right? And so we're creating all of this new data. It's going to continue to grow. There has to be a way to crunch it. There has to be a way to store it. There has to be a way to understand it. There has to be a way to analyze it. And as we do that, we get better outcomes and we also become more efficient. I mean, think about it. You know, 25 years ago, think how expensive computers were. A computer that could just do a couple of things would cost thousands and thousands of dollars. Now they're almost disposable, you know, a couple hundred bucks and you have. And so when you think of all of that efficiency, of that wave of industrial revolution, of the wave of computerization into everything. AI is kind of the next big wave of that. And so we're going to find ourselves in the situation where the companies that are at the forefront of that, they're going to continue to be dominant. So do I think that there's room in the Magnificent Seven for continued demand and continued growth and continued margin expansion? The answer to that is yes. But I also think there's a tremendous amount of opportunity in the rest of the S&P 500 as companies learn how to apply all of this AI to whatever it is they're doing. Whatever they're manufacturing, they're going to be able to manufacture it better and less expensively and have greater profit margins. Whatever good they're delivering, they're going to be able to apply AI and develop margin expansion there. So the winners are not just the people that are at the forefront of artificial intelligence, but the winners are the companies that are at the forefront of the application of that. I mean, if you go back to the 1980s, Walmart put a 386 computer in every cash register. That revolutionized retail in America because they could really become, and look what happened to Walmart, right? And so that by applying that technology to what it was they were already doing, they created this massive efficiency that allowed them to drive down costs, that allowed them to pick up market share and become a dominant player. There's going to be more of those companies. The ones who win aren't just the guys who create AI, but it's the guys who use it most efficiently to make lives better for everybody.
You've seen companies like Apple, so to speak, that have scrapped an EV vehicle to really concentrate on AI. So there's a lot of companies, I would assume, that are trying to concentrate with AI, learn how to use it better, use it in their products. And Apple's one of those stocks that have gotten hit kind of recently because China, they're not selling as many phones in China. The Chinese economy, not from all reports, isn't as good as it is here in the U.S., but they're really concentrating on the AI thing. So that's one of those companies that are going to look to increase margins, do better, make their products better through AI.
That's exactly right. And I think that when you think of Apple, it's really the dominant consumer products company of the world, in my opinion. And they're so large. They have, if you think of the Apple platform, there's about $1.1 trillion worth of you know, income and products and stuff that roll through the App Store every year, right? And when you take a look at $1.1 trillion running through things that Apple touches, right? That's like the entire economy of, I think, Norway, which is like number 18 or something like that. So when these people just forget how big it really is, this entire ecosystem that they have that affects our daily lives. And so I think that's important. So while, you know, the stock may be affected from a headline standpoint, saying, oh, well, China's slowing down, you know, there's a whole slowing down is not stopping. And there's a whole lot of other people in the world that use Apple products. So we think that they're going to continue to be a dominant company for decades to come.
Why doesn't something like that come out? I mean, you hear when earnings come out and they look at forward guidance and they say, oh, well, you know, we took a hit in China. We didn't sell as many phones as we thought we would. But look at our apps. We're doing over $1 trillion with our apps. Why don't people latch on to the good and they're like, oh, so sales were down in China, so we have a problem, but we're still cash positive. We still have a ton of cash reserves and we're sinking those cash reserves into AI.
Well, I think that you know that old adage that bad news sells, right? So everyone's looking for the thing. Everyone is always looking for the thing that knocks something down. And I tend to look for the thing that carries something through or drives it up. As an economist, a lot of people talk about the unemployment rate, but what I really want to look at is how many people really have jobs, because what really drives an economy is aggregate demand, right? So how many people have jobs? How many are making money? How many are doing that? I want to look at that number because that's going to tell us what's more going on in the future. And I think that we really have to step back and try to get out of the quarter by quarter, week by week news cycle with regard to companies, because what really matters is this company going to make money for the long term? And so they may have one bad quarter, or they may have some short-term stuff, or you could have an exogenous event like you have a pandemic, right? But you take a look over a long period of time, you see this massive recovery. So this is when I talk about people, you know, in their individual portfolios, you know, kind of like, you know, the old keep calm and buy on dips, right? That's the thing. You know, try to take advantage of volatility and not be its victim. Don't play into the panic that everybody wants to instill in you, but rather ask yourself a fundamental question. Is someone going to buy this company's product and continue to do it? I mean, people don't change that much. I mean, think about it. Why did the Romans have gladiators? Well, it's because they didn't have the NFL. I mean, it's that it. And then think about when we were young, what did we do? We pulled out the Sears and Roebuck or Montgomery Ward catalog and we drew pictures on it. We circled, you know, what we wanted for Christmas. We showed our parents, right? We said, here, this is what I want. This is the picture of what I want. And our parents did something as archaic as they wrote a check and filled out a form and they mailed it in. Well, now we do the same thing. You're just looking at your laptop or your mobile device as your catalog. You press a few buttons, you pay for it with a credit card, and instead of taking 4 to 6 weeks, it shows up in 4 to 6 hours. and what we do does not change. The how we do it changes. And this is why we're big fans of e-commerce. We're big fans of companies that are involved in that because they're transformative in how the American consumer, which is really the driving force of most of the global economy, how the American consumer is executing the fundamental fulfillment of their desires. And so we really take a hard look at that, and we watch what people are doing, and that's where we want to make sure we invest. And I think we talk about investing in the no matter what, and that's what people do. And I think that's how you get through all of this noise. And I think that's the big thing. Step back. One of the hardest things for people to do, I think, particularly if investors are doing it themselves, is step away from the keyboard and think about what does this really mean long term? And if you have, because you're not, segregate your money, right? Are you investing as a recreation for the next 5 days or the next 5 weeks? Or are you investing for the next 5 years or 50 years? And you need to kind of look at those two things differently. And I think that's what we spend a lot of time trying to talk people into doing.
So you spend a lot of time evaluating investment portfolios on the fundamentals of stocks, basically, not the news or not the cycles, but you're going to look at the numbers and look, yeah, maybe this quarter was down, but their fundamentals are really good. It's like when Warren Buffett sold a little bit of Apple, everybody's like, oh my God, Apple's, it was such a small percentage of his portfolio. And then Warren Buffett came out and said, look, Apple's fundamentals are still very good.
Absolutely. I think we invest in really two things or three things. The first one is we'll look at policy, right? Governments have policy that drive people to do certain things. And then we look at fundamental human behavior. I mean, Abraham Maslow did a great study back in the 1943 as we prepared to go into D-Day and World War II. And 6,000 years of human history says that you're first going to fulfill your physiological needs, then your need for safety and security, then your need for love and belonging, then your need for self-esteem and your need for self-actualization. I mean, people really don't change. So we first look at what is the fundamental human desire. Let's look at the consumer. What are they going to use their dollars to vote for? What are they going to do first? And then we try to look at the company that is best positioned at that choke point, who's best of class, who can deliver on that, because they'll have pricing power. And pricing power turns into excess earnings. And excess earnings turns into better stock performance. It's not any more complicated than that. So, yes, it's very much driven by fundamentals. And you just ask yourself, is the consumer going to change? Are they changing from this product to the other? They don't change that quickly, right? You get fads, and that's where luxury goods come in. You'll have sometime a luxury, you know, everybody's got to have this. But I think that when you begin to focus purely on the fundamentals and say who's going to have the best earnings, and are those earnings going to be predictable over a long period of time? When we look at a company, before we would get out of a name or something like that, we ask a couple of fundamental questions. Is there something wrong with the big knowable theme? There's big knowable themes driving a lot of people to do something. Is there something wrong with the big knowable theme? Has that changed? Is there something wrong with the choke point? Is there something wrong with that particular point in time that's actually allowing excess earnings to occur? Or is there something wrong with the company in and of itself? They just no longer can execute on whatever it was. We look at those three factors, and if something's wrong there, then we'll consider backing away from a company. But other than that, we just say, no, you're probably going to plow through because consumers consume, and that's what they do. And if you've got the right product, you have the right choke point, you have a big knowable theme driving people to do a lot of stuff, you're going to have good fundamental earnings through the cycle. You're investing. It's not a recreational sport. And I think that that's what people have to pay attention to.
One of the last things I want to touch on, as you talked about consumer spending and habits, we're entering the spring and summer travel season, and oil seems like it's creeping up, which means gas prices are going to creep up again. It's just the nature of the beast. Mm-hmm. Where do you see oil going? I know there's a lot of geopolitical pressure on, the Middle East right now. A lot of the oil comes from there. Where do you see the price of oil going and the summer travel season?
Well, I think we're going to see oil, it had dropped down a bit. Now we're heading in that mid 80s, range. I think, typically things work okay in that 80 to 85 range. It's expensive. People make decisions around it. I mean, there's two most recognizable prices in America. Right? The price of gasoline and your mortgage. You know what you pay for gas. You know what you pay for your mortgage. You probably don't know what you pay for peanut butter. And so people pay attention to that. And we are seeing some elevated gas prices. We're going to start moving into that. And I think as long as you don't have a sustained oil price north of 85 or 90, you're going to be okay. You get oil north of $100 a barrel, that becomes recessionary, and it's very difficult to sustain that. But the United States is producing more oil now than they ever have. We're producing more oil now than at any point in our history, and I think that we're also beginning to do that. I think you're going to have the two other players that are Iran and the Soviet Union, Iran and Russia. Sorry, I'm an old soldier. I still call myself.
Yeah, I hear you.
but Iran and Russia, they have two wars going on. So in order to fund those wars, they have to keep pumping oil, and that's going to keep oil supplies up. And I think that we'll probably see this moment where oil will probably peak, get up around 80 to 85, and then we'll have more supply come on the market, and markets will adjust. So I think the prices will be elevated but sustainable. It may cause people to change their travel habits just a little bit, but I think it's still going to be a very robust travel season. We like the luxury and leisure segments of the market. People are still wanting to take that trip and do that thing. And I think that consumer behavior has moved a little bit more towards experiences, whether that's individuals or families. And so whether we're hitting the road globally or we're hitting the road here in the United States, I think it's going to be a busy season this summer. And it's going to be good for companies that are involved in that.
Well, and that'll be good for the economy to keep growing strong. So that'll be a nice thing.
Absolutely. Money tends to work its way through the economy. There's a multiplier effect to what consumers do. And I think here's one thing that we forgot. During the pandemic, we put $5.4 trillion into the economy. That's more, and we did it in 1 year. That's more money than we put into the entire economy during World War II. So we have 4 years of World War II. We put in about $5.1 trillion. And then during the pandemic, we put in $5.4 trillion. That's a huge amount of money that's working its way through the economy. It doesn't go poof overnight. It goes and it has a multiplier effect and it works its way through. So we're going to continue to feel the effects of the stimulus coming from the pandemic for probably, you know, several more years. And I think that that helps provide this underlying strength that we're seeing in the economy. And you know, people worry about the Fed and interest rates. I know that's kind of on our list of things to talk about here. We think that the Fed's probably going to, you know, it's not going to be six, it's probably three, maybe two now. And they don't have to raise interest rates. They just have to wait and just wait. And just wait. And they'll have the continued effect of slowing things down. They're getting the result they want, right? But they're slowing it down slowly, and that will bleed out some of this inflation. So for those who are expecting a quick reduction in interest rates, I think they're going to be disappointed. But I think the Fed's just going to roll this thing out a little later. They'll be talking about, yeah, we'll do it in June for the first one. Well, maybe July, you know, and begin to push it out. And we probably see, you know, two cuts, maybe three this year. But the Fed doesn't have to raise rates. They just have to wait for things to bleed out a little bit. And I think that's where we're going to be.
Patience. Everybody has to be patient.
Just a little bit.
So what's your best advice for investors today, other than patience?
Other than patience. I think the thing is don't get all excited about trading. There's billions and billions and billions of dollars being spent advertising, trying to get you to trade your portfolio. When what you really need to do is think about the fundamentals of the companies. Am I well positioned owning companies that are going to make money off of what consumers do? And if you do, then you know, forego that urge to trade every day and recognize what you really should do is let your money be your money. And let you be you. You know, you live your life, let your money work hard for you, but don't push it around every day. I think that that's probably a good way to look at things. And so we kind of tell people that, you know, if you step back and you look at it, it's all going to be pretty okay. And we just kind of move through it.
Thanks so much for joining us. Where can we find you on social media?
Basically, you know, the easiest way to find me is at PenceWealthManagement.com. You can find me at also at Pence Capital Management, and you can also find me at Pence Financial Group. So all three of those entities are affiliated with us. All three of them are there designed to help investors and help consumers. And we look forward to anything that we can do to help anybody at any time.
We thank you so much for joining us. It was awesome insights, and I think that your demeanor in investing and your knowledge in investing and the way you go about it is phenomenal, and I really appreciate you joining me, and I know our viewers will appreciate your insights as well. Thank you.
Absolutely. Happy to be here. Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun.
That's a wrap on another discussion here on Wealthion. Thank you for joining us. If you need help being financially resilient, please head over to Wealthion.com and sign up for a free, no obligation consultation from one of our vetted registered investment advisors. And remember to follow us on social media for the latest news and information to help you invest wisely. Thank you for watching. And until next time, stay informed, stay empowered, and may your investments flourish.
Mm-hmm.